Last month, we explored the story of a fake suicide epidemic on Twitter and Tumblr. In the time that we've all grown up with the internet, we've seen this kind of behavior before. We know not to feed the troll. But at the turn of the millennium, people didn't know that yet. What do you do when a blogger you think you know is dying of cancer? I'm Stephanie B., and this is Ephemera. In 1999, the internet was a very different place. Google had been founded in 98, but nobody used it. A 1999 book I found called A Rough Guide to the Internet didn't even list it under its heading for search engines. Instead, it recommended AltaVista and Hotbot. People played Quake. Researchers estimated that 90% of internet traffic was taken up by people downloading porno images. Truly, it was a simpler time. 1999 also saw the coining of the word blog from 97's more cumbersome weblog. A 1999 list of notable blogs I found has a mere 23 entries. The blog this story is about wasn't one of them at the time, but the events of this story saw it become something that was widely shared and talked about online. Over the course of 2 years, the blog acquired some 2 million hits, hardly chump change now, and even more impressive nearly 20 years ago. Casey Nicole, the blogger, was an 18-year-old girl from Kansas getting ready for college. She played basketball and was charismatic, sweet, and kind. People on collegeclub.com, where she e-journaled, really seemed to like her. She posted photos, her poetry, and talked about her earnest love for God. You know, teen shit. A New York Times article about College Club quotes her briefly. The article, which was about the startling new phenomenon of computer use by college students, identifies her as Casey Swenson, not Casey Nicole. I've linked it in the show notes. She talks about the importance of balancing online and offline lives, and says that when she talks to her mom about how things used to be, she can't believe what students had to put up with. Meanwhile, Casey kept blogging. She spent a lot of time in the College Club chat rooms, especially the romance and love chat room. These posters are the ones she's talking about in the New York Times article when she says she talks to people online, quote, every day. It's around this time that she meets Randall van der Woning, a fiction writer living in Hong Kong. Van der Woning is probably better known online by his alias, BWG. In 2000, Casey told BWG over chat that she had been fighting with leukemia, but was in remission. Not long after, she confided in him that the cancer had come back. BWG, now a genuine friend of hers, offered to host and set up a space for her to blog about her illness if she wanted. Casey accepted, and they registered a blog called In Living Color. On In Living Color, Casey wrote with the same intimacy and candor that she'd been writing with on College Club, but it wasn't trivial anymore. She wrote in painful detail about her hospital stays and her fear of death, but spoke optimistically about her chances. The tone of the whole blog is positive, actually. Her first post.
I'm beginning a new, exciting journey. It's a journey into my survival. I want to win! I'll fight to the finish.
People online fell in love with her voice. This teenage girl from Kansas had gone from scoring layups to laying down in a hospital bed.
I kept having this vision of myself today. I was sitting on a white fence, surrounded by thick grass, and a field spotted with wild flowers. It was a perfect, clear, warm day. I had the feeling of being so content. What I remember most is no pain. Just massive, glowing sensation of being whole. The constant pain inside my body wasn't there.
Sometimes she was too sick, either from the cancer or the chemo, to post. When she was in really bad shape, her mom, Debbie Swenson, emailed BWG and asked him to upload things for her. No matter what happened, she kept her spirits up, and her faith in God remained unshaken. Over the next 2 years, her blog attracted millions of views. People sent well wishes, cards, and flowers. One friend received an autographed baseball cap. Kansas City Royals. KC, get it? Casey's health worsened. After a near-death experience in 2000, she began to recover but was worse than before. In April of 2001, she told BWG over IM that her liver had begun to fail. This was the point of no return. She was going to die, and soon. In grief, he insisted on coming to visit her. She said, okay, but that she and her mom were driving to Miami to see a close family friend before she passed. She wanted to see the ocean, to hear seagulls, and feel the salt spray on her skin. BWG blogged about it for her. When she got back, the two of them began to make serious arrangements for BWG to visit her in Kansas. A few days later, on the 15th of May, Debbie called BWG on the phone. She wept inconsolably and told him that Casey had died in the night of an aneurysm. The next day, after he'd prepared himself and figured out how to tell people, he posted an update to In Living Colors. 3 short sentences. Thank you for the love, the joy, the laughter, and the tears. We shall love you always and forever. Casey Nicole passed away May 14th. 2001, at the age of 19. The outpouring of grief from readers of the blog, as well as the internet denizens at Metafilter, was enormous. But for a few posters on Metafilter, something about Casey's death felt wrong, off. 2 days after BWG's announcement, MeFi user AcridRabbit posted a thread. That thread's title?
Is it possible that KC did not exist? This is a really delicate thing here. Please be really thoughtful about this. I promise I am not trying to stir the shit without cause. There are some people who are wondering whether KC was a real 19-year-old leukemia patient, and whether things actually occurred the way they've been reported online. More inside, friends.
He replies to his own OP. As the fourth reply, people really cared about this, and says the following.
From the message boards relating to the death, I was given the impression that she died at home, very suddenly, and without pain. However, even if her death were attended by a doctor, they both said in the blogs that they didn't know what had caused her sudden death. Then they came back with the information that it was a ruptured vein. Since that's an internal injury and not outwardly visible, the body would have had to have been opened. If the death was attended by a doctor, and he or she was happy to sign off on it and send her to the mortician, that still only leaves 2 days to have her embalmed, cremated, to make all the arrangements for a memorial service, for everyone to attend a memorial service, and, according to the blogs, her father lived out of state, to have everything on Thursday already wrapped and announced that it's been done.
There was resistance.
If it was a hoax, it's the most elaborate knit hoax I've ever seen. It would mean that her original page is fake, and every email John shared with her was answered by someone else. I've got an email from Debbie before. Was that fake?
It seems much too elaborate to be faked. If it was, wouldn't someone slip up along the way? I mean, how could someone keep up a story going for almost a year? With hundreds of posts to several personalities and never screw up until the end. It just doesn't seem possible.
Here's BWG's reply to Acrid Rabbit's thread.
Stop. 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 This is deplorable. This is making me sick to my stomach. I've spoken to Casey on the phone, as well as her mother numerous times. I can assure you Casey was quite real. There are many holes in this theory. Those heartless, sickening articles. Someone clearly does not have all the facts. and the conclusions he has jumped to are ludicrous. Has it ever occurred to anyone that KC Nicole was her first and middle name? That we left out her first and last name deliberately when we started this blog as a measure of protection for her and her family? That she lives in Kansas but not Newton? And that there was a reason for having a P.O. box there as opposed to her hometown? KC was a wonderful human being. Her mother is devastated by this loss. It's not bad enough that I've lost someone so close and so dear to me. But now you're asking me to prove it? As far as I'm concerned, all the cynics can go to hell.
But the skeptics, who began calling themselves the Scooby-Doos, kept digging.
You want a school mascot for Casey's team? I'll give you one. Take the basketball photo and resize it to 30% width and 200% height. You get this. Take a look at the floor beneath Casey's foot. Don't see it yet? Let's rotate, adjust brightness, contrast, and do a bit of smudge brush extrapolation from the existing pixels. And you get this. Still don't see it? I'll take Lady Lines for 800, Alex.
If Casey Brandon is still alive, then she clearly isn't Casey Nicole. However, she could unwittingly be the source of the pictures. After all, participants in this thread found them. A hoaxer could, too. I'm convinced the basketball picture is indeed Casey Brandon. The similarity to the picture that Zosia found is striking. Also, Lady Warriors, with Lady correct but Warriors faked, matches nicely with Casey Brandon's real team name of Lady Tigers. And indeed, if the newspaper report on Casey Brandon from February is genuine, and there's no reason to doubt it, then she can't be Casey Nicole, because no one undergoing chemotherapy is going to be able to continue playing basketball.
Still other posters began to throw their opinions out there, even while the Scooby-Doos gathered evidence.
I think you have to view the internet as just another medium. If someone made the same plea on television, or via the telephone, or by mail, I'm sure you'd question it at least a little bit. For whatever reason, we've come to see the internet as this wholly trustworthy thing from the get-go, and it's taken several good, old-fashioned hoaxes to let people know that it's not the golden child new form of communication that some people might still believe it to be. Actually, I don't know anyone who's been on the web or used its precursors that doesn't have at least some wariness. I guess the fact that so many people believed shows there's a newer sensibility prevalent on the web.
If you were real, a few thousand people would have loved to have met you. Why didn't you let them? If this is a hoax, wake me up so I can join the lynch mob.
The Scooby-Doos managed to pretty conclusively show that Casey Nicole was a fake person who'd never existed. Most of the evidence pointed to Debbie Swenson, Casey's mom, as the person behind the hoax. The basketball photos of Casey were instead the daughter of a family friend who remained ignorant of the hoax until Debbie called her father to apologize. It also arose that Debbie didn't invent the Casey persona. Her teenage daughter, Kelly Swenson, did, with her friends, as a game of pretend. Debbie found out, and the kids dropped the character, but then Debbie picked it up again. The messages to BWG, the cancer blog, and even as far back as the college club e-journaling and chatroom modding were all Debbie's pathology. Both BWG and another early friend of Casey's, Halcyon, believed that the person they spoke to on the phone was Debbie disguising her voice. Halcyon used to work for college club, and had offered Casey a paid position as a step up from her chat mod duties. She dispensed love advice to teens and 20-somethings. But she had said no, telling him she was just in it for the love of the game. At the time, he'd shrugged it off. There's a name for this kind of behavior, where people pretend to be sick or traumatized so that other people will be sympathetic to or pay attention to them. It's called Munchausen syndrome, after Baron Munchausen, a once famous recounter of implausible deeds. The DSM calls it factitious disorder imposed on self, but I'm a romantic, not a doctor, damn it. We now understand a subcategory. Munchausen by internet, which I called Munchausen by proxy server last month. The pattern was identified in 1998 by psychologist Mark Feldman, and it isn't in the DSM, but it's a useful way to understand cases like this one. Debbie, as Casey, tells BWG that she's in remission from cancer, and then she ups the ante and tells him that it's back. His honest concern and care for an online friend pushed Debbie into a situation she felt like she couldn't escape, that her only way out was forward. Here's how she justifies herself. Once the Scooby-Doos have more or less conclusively shown that she's behind the whole thing, and has been for 2 years.
My intentions were good, but that does not begin to excuse me for what I have done. My only desire was to share their triumphs and tragedies in a way that showed their strength, the strength of their families. Those were not false. What they went through was real. I felt a great need to tell the stories of three courageous people who wanted nothing but to be well and live happily into their prime. What I did was wrong, and I apologize for it. I regret any pain I caused, but I do not regret putting their thoughts out to be read. There were more and deeper parts of their lives, and I did them a grave disservice. I carry the shame for my actions. The last thing I would like to say is I'm sorry.
I believe that she felt earnest remorse and felt trapped. But whose life among us hasn't been touched by cancer? Was this really about extrapolating small moments of strength into a larger-than-life story of plucky teen girl heroism? I don't think so. Debbie did this selfishly, at first to feel cared about, and later because she didn't know how to stop. All she had to do was confess, and she did, eventually, but far too late. The hoax really messed with BWG, and Halcyon, as well as others who'd become regular readers of her blog. Among other things, here's something Halcyon sent to his mailing list.
It's interesting. I was wounded twice on Sunday. First by the news of deceit in my life. Secondly, when I chose to have my left nipple pierced. I was planning on doing the piercing for my 30th birthday, but the events of the hoax made my desire for a dramatic life experience more urgent. The symbolism of the piercing took a direction I didn't expect. The piercing has been slow to heal. Each day I think it's better, and each day I see blood from the still fresh wound. It aches almost constantly. But both wounds will heal.
I think it's interesting to trace this event from almost 20 years ago, one of the first big cases of people online buying into someone's delusion and then being hurt when the truth comes out. The Scooby-Doos felt personally hurt, I think, by Debbie's deception. People called up local newspaper editors, went through the phone book of Kansas Swenson's, and even found and spoke to Debbie's former pastor, who remembered that she loved to write poetry. There was a real sense that this was, if not totally unprecedented, unprecedented at least in scope and immorality. And yet, amid the cries for increased skepticism, the Scooby-Doos, as well as others, resolved not to let it damage their faith in the internet and the telling of personal stories. Here's the rest of Halcyon's message.
It seems like I should be spiritually destroyed, but oddly I don't feel that way. More than anything, I feel surrounded by love. Take Casey out of the equation. You have a community of people who loved together, hurt together, learned together, and consoled each other. My inbox is filled with messages of love. Instead of hugging each other over the death of a 19-year-old girl, we are consoling each other over the death of a belief. Instead of helping each other to keep Casey's spirit alive within each other, we are helping each other keep our faith in humanity alive. To everyone who is extending their hearts to each other now, thank you. Casey may not be real, but the love flowing through the net right now is.
P.S. Almost 10 years to the day later, Wikipedia's fact of the day for May 13th, 2011 read,
Did you know that the perpetrator of the Casey Nicole hoax was investigated by the FBI, but charges were never filed because the financial loss was not enough?
Next month on Ephemera, the photos are all gone, but the forum posts remain. It's the story of one of the most spectacular goon project failures from Something Awful. I'm also launching a Patreon for the podcast. There's a link in the show notes. $3 a month gets you commentary tracks for each episode, the original pilot for the show, and first priority on voice acting roles, if you want it. If you'd like to get in touch, shoot me an email at ephemerathepodcast@gmail.com. I'd like to thank everyone who helped me read lines for this show, the Wayback Machine and the Internet Archive for their incredible archival work, and most of all, you for listening.